human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon. Mickey and Peter will return next week. On today's program, we're going to discuss fascism in the U.S. and how to resist its creeping influence. Our guest is author Alexander Reed Ross, and he'll be discussing his new book, Against the Fascist Creep. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Nicholas Baham III and our senior correspondent Michael Levitin. So today's theme of the show, we're going to be talking about fascism and fascism under the Trump regime. And I have to say, I've noticed that people seem to be really afraid of this term. I find like it's really underused, but I find it to be an accurate term. So I don't understand the fear of using this term. I mean, all these definitions of fascism seem to fit with the Trump regime in my mind. The non-recognition of human rights, the development of scapegoats, the megalomania of the leader, the control of mass media for propaganda purposes. Am I crazy? What do you guys think? Am I missing something here?
No, I think you're onto something. Certainly with the media, that's the way that the public can most easily see what's going on in a fascist way, because true fascism works in a up is down, false is true, left is right kind of way. And we get it from Orwell, which everybody now is reading across the country and across the world. People have suddenly really tuned in quickly to what the prior history, what our history in the 20th century of fascism is, and trying to understand, I think, because they're seeing these creeping signs that aren't even so creeping. Trump came out firing from day one, and his press team and his messaging, and even in the press conferences, the brief ones that he's been giving, he is demonstrating sort of this disloyalty to straightforward, factual explanations about anything, really.
Yeah, and I'm not really convinced that there's anybody in the mainstream media who's sophisticated enough to be able to provide a definition to mass audiences about what fascism really is. So I think that there's a little bit of education that our media has to go through. Certainly our mainstream media has to go through to understand what fascism is in the first place. The other thing that I'm curious about is I know that the left for the 8 years of Obama were kind of defending themselves to a degree against charges from the extreme right about Obama's fascism, right? For me, that wasn't necessarily a valid claim, but I think it's important to, you know, politics are not along a single line. There is, to a degree, a circle, and there's a point where the extreme left meets the extreme right, right? So you have to have some sophistication to be able to elaborate that as well. And maybe you had a right-wing media that alleged fascism on the extreme left. You have a left-wing media that alleges fascism from the extreme right, right? How does the middle deal with those two narratives? How do you make sense of it and come to a sense of clarity about what's really going on? And maybe even a critique of the fact that the left and the right, to some degree in this country, at least Democrats and Republicans, are a facade of an authoritarian regime that rages on no matter whether you have a Democrat or a Republican in the office.
It seems as though when they were getting on Obama for those years, all the Fox News and all the right pundits, more communism seemed to be,
correct,
if you had to bring up one of them, fascism or communism, because they were concerned about the creep, too much government and too much influence. Somehow it was an overtake of our government, whereas now we've got a deregulatory president who wants to give all the reins to business. Seems to resemble more like the fascism that we think of, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I took a couple of moments to do something that was slightly damaging to my mental health, which was to listen to a couple of minutes of the Glenn Beck program the other day. And Beck was discussing this theory that he has about actually left-wing authoritarianism within the Trump administration, because he won't sort of concede to the right-wing authoritarian elements. So his argument is that the authoritarian aspect of the Trump regime is coming directly from Steve Bannon, but he characterizes Steve Bannon as a Leninist and as a disciple of Saul Alinsky. These were the same charges that were leveled against Obama, as you remember. But what's being left out of that narrative is a substantive critique of white nationalist, extreme right-wing politics that Steve Bannon and Breitbart are clearly a part of. So it almost seems like the right-wing authoritarians want to call out the left-wing authoritarians and then are incapable of providing any kind of a critique on their side of their own behavior, and same thing with the left-wing.
And the reason I brought this up, too, is that there was this leaked memo the AP Press was reporting that Trump is considering to mobilize 100,000 National Guard troops to round up the so-called unauthorized immigrants, as the AP Press calls them. What is a larger sign of a time to use this term, or at least, as I think you point out aptly, is discuss this term? It seems totally gone from any discussion in the corporate media. It's almost like we've used like this Frank Luntz narrative of the alternative right is what they're calling it. Get as close as possible without actually saying it.
I think it's hard to define the current regime in the old terms. I think we probably are going to have to come up with a bit of a new vocabulary because this isn't 20th century fascism. Trump is not Mussolini. He is not Hitler. He is not one of these figures that people, oh, well, let's look at, you know, Germany and the war years. It is not like that. We are in transnational, corporate-owned 21st century, very different and more complex. And the point that you brought up, Nick, this idea that, you know, Bannon can be considered an archetypal, I don't know, like a far leftist. I don't think he is because of his white nationalist and authoritarian nature, but he is kind of like an anarchist mm-hmm. in the sense that he wants to blow everything up. Right. Bannon has this crazy destroy it all, burn it to the ground march and kind of you know, headwind behind him. He reads all war texts. He is obsessed with wartime history, back to Thucydides and the Greeks and the Persians and you know, Krishna, everything. He is all about destruction, and he believes that you create a new world order out of complete leveling of the establishment. That is who Trump has brought in to be his lead propagandist. I don't know if you call that old school traditional fascism.
What it is it's a very sophisticated blend of, let's call it, for lack of a better expression, the best hits, the top hits of either left-wing extremism or right-wing extremism. And apparently I have not read deeply enough in this, so I think for a lot of us, we're catching up on the new discursive formations that we're living in now. But there is an extreme right-wing theorist, last name of Dugin, who has this notion of blending the best elements of, say, Lenin, Hitler, etc., right? And putting those all together.
Throw Stalin in there while you're at it.
Exactly. As well as that anarchist impulse to just watch the world burn, right? In order to create this new world order. And then you've also got to throw in some of the influence of Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations. So it's a very complicated stew that I think is in Bannon's head, and hence in Trump's head as well. We're going to have to come up with new discursive formations to get our hands around the scope of this.
And the first thing goes back to your point, Nolan, about calling out, you know, mistruths and that fascism relies on media and propaganda. The more that the media and the more that the public calls out their falsehoods from the get-go, which has been a pretty strong sign of democratic health in the country, in that people aren't taking what they are saying at their value. People are seeing through it from the start, the media, the corporate media even in a lot of ways, and the public. So I think it's going to be about how we respond.
Well, as our listeners and supporters know, Media Freedom Foundation, through our various projects, the Global Critical Media Literacy Project and Project Censored, we try and unearth stories and perspectives you don't hear in the corporate press. And so I think it's a good time. We should get to our headlines. Alicia.
I'm Alicia Guajardo with the Media Freedom Foundation. Here's just some of the stories we are working on for you. At projectcensored.org, readers will find Dark Days and the Coming of Fascism in the New America, written by Jeremy Cloward of Diablo Valley College. The article argues that today there is nothing stopping the American Republic, which has already devolved into a plutocracy and is recognized as such by even some mainstream political science scholars, from disintegrating further. Also at gcml.org, that is the Global Critical Media Literacy Project's website, gcml.org, supporters will find Extreme Weather and Global Warming, written by Ruben Sacido, a student at California Maritime Academy. The article documents how in 2016, the corporate media ignored the critical connection between extreme weather and global warming, while the independent media covered the correlation between extreme weather and global warming. Also at gcml.org, you can read Understanding Social Media and Privacy. This is another article developed by Allison Butler with her University of Massachusetts student, Molly McKinney, Allison Levin, Anna Marie Wadiak, and Benjamin Mancall. The free pamphlet includes lesson plans that are designed to teach preteens and teenagers how to make sense of social media and privacy. Each lesson has age-appropriate lessons and activities that explore social media history, privacy expectations, and ways to work directly with social media in order to understand privacy choices and implications. You can view the lesson plans at gcml.org.
Dr. Allison Butler does some incredible work. So that's a really great pamphlet online. She's done a series of these at gcml.org. And if you're an educator, librarian, or just a media consumer, it's a really great pamphlet. So I got to make sure I give a double plug for that. Alicia, do you have any other headlines for us?
Last, we have Julie Frechette of University of Worcester published Remembering the 2016 Presidential Election, which can also be found at gcml.org. The article argues that while people may disregard Trump's memes as playful and harmless, the fact remains that Trump got away with making some of the most unprofessional statements ever made by a presidential candidate. I'm Alicia Guajardo, and that is the news that did not make the news.
Thank you very much, Alicia. We'll be back after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Nicholas Baham III, and as always, our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin. We had a report come out by the Southern Poverty Law Center that during the 2016 presidential election, especially specifically around Trump's campaign, there was a rise in white nationalist and neo-Nazi media outlets flooding social media and news outlets. This was a topic I wrote about 3 years ago with my article, Disinfo Wars on Alex Jones, where I talked about how the sort of insane things that Jones and his supporters say on the internet or in radio are then picked up by outlets like Drudge Report, who are then used by outlets like Hannity on Fox and used for fodder. So we always sort of think of Jones as this fringe outside the spectrum individual. And most people, I don't even think, know who Alex Jones is. But his viewpoints actually make it into the corporate press. I even heard Howard Stern had him on his show recently, which reaches millions of viewers. And Jones claims that Trump actually called him to say thanks for the support on the presidential campaign. Jones has said things like, I'm ready to die for Trump. So I'm a little curious, what do you think about this connection is between like Jones and this hate rhetoric and these white nationalist groups to this Muslim ban that went into place, this talk of mass deportation that has gone into place? It seems like this white neo-Nazi media has played a role in informing people or justifying this behavior in enough people's minds where we can have a Muslim ban or this roundup of supposed undocumented immigrants. How do you combat something like that? How do you combat this sort of media and the influence it's having on this swath of the population?
Well, you know, I think that some of the ideas of how to deal with this were laid out many decades ago by Jean-Paul Sartre in Anti-Semite and Jew, where Sartre made it very clear that it's impossible to put this kind of racial hate that's filled with emotion and passion against someone who wants to make a logical argument against it. There's no way that you can win, in short. And in effect, by embracing Alex Jones, what the mainstream media is doing is it's setting up people who espouse the ideas of a liberal democracy and plurality and embrace the multi-ethnic immigrant society that we have. It's pitting them against this sort of passionate, frankly illogical, unreasonable white nationalist sentiment. There's no way that you can win within that format where passion meets logical reasoning. In some way or the other, through lies, invectives, or just straight out emotional statements of hate, that will always, in the public's view, always overcome the logical reasoning of someone who is, frankly, a centrist in some sense.
Yeah, and it's not always even so passionate and emotional. They've developed a sophisticated method of speaking in code words, and mm-hmm. that started, you know, well back in the Reagan years and previously, where welfare moms, you want to talk about problems in Black America, you just mentioned welfare moms, and that was sort of the early days, and that has evolved into, we don't live in red state America necessarily, but the radio, the talk shows, and how it's become basically part of everyday culture, the fabric of conversation. I think it isn't always as emotional and blatant, but the subtle, the undertones of racism or of white identity, white nationalism. It's obviously really clear because that's what Trump relied on in his speeches, which weren't always overtly nationalist and speaking to white power, but clearly he spoke to them.
I mean, I think what's happening is that the fringe has deconstructed the mainstream so that the fringe is now mainstream. You have, frankly, a white nationalist government because of the presence of people like Steve Bannon. So the Muslim ban is, and the roundups that we're now seeing of immigrants are the expression of a white nationalist government. The statement that Trump recently made about putting National Guard out there in the streets, and the executive orders that he signed about increasing police power or the possibility of bringing more policing to the streets of Chicago or the National Guard, you're already seeing the project happening. So, you know, the discourse, the deconstruction has already gone down, okay? For those of us who are not white nationalists, as I am not, and then the four of us in this studio are not, we have to now engage in our own project of taking that space back, okay? So it has to be an active, ongoing project of deconstructing this new white nationalist mainstream. In a sense, you're going back to doing the work that you had to do in the 60s because we've slipped back. We've lost some ground. So maybe we gained 25 yards between 1965 and the present. But somehow or the other, through penalties, holding calls, and so forth and so on, we've been moved back another 35.
I would completely agree. And I think the press has sort of taken this idea of deconstructing this white nationalist power, but in the total wrong direction. Like Trump voters, they go out and analyze them. So on the Muslim ban, like nearly every corporate network goes out and they start studying how Trump voters feel about the Muslim ban. Personally, I think it doesn't really matter. That's not the community, I think, that's dramatically affected by the Muslim ban, right? But they say they go examine the Trump voters. And meanwhile, Jones is getting coverage in the mainstream. I think you hit the nail on the head that the fringe is now the mainstream. He made this comment about how Jennifer Lopez should go to Somalia, where she'll be, quote, gang raped so fast it'll make your head spin. Jones has always said insane things, disgusting things, misogynist things like this in his career. But now they're actually being covered and discussed, like analyzing. And I think your point about Sard is right on, that now it's, they pretend like they're analyzing and studying him, but really what Jones is given a platform. Now more people are knowing about Jones. Like these conversations are being more normalized rather than sort of deconstructed and properly marginalized, right?
And those sites, I mean, I don't know if you said earlier that Jones, you know, it's InfoWars, that's his site. And I don't think that's very far from Breitbart. I mean, these are sites that do not operate with the truth. They are not journalism or media sites. They are entertainment, popular rumor and conspiracy mills that essentially, like you said, then they get on Hannity. They get picked up by Drudge, then they go on Hannity. All of a sudden they're in Fox and they're in 200 million people are watching them and they're going all around the world with views that essentially should stay in the basement. The fact that it makes it out there is the frightening thing, and that now they have a national podium for it.
Jones and these others for decades almost, right, criticized corporate media. And unfortunately, a broken clock can be right twice a day. And they were right in that critique. The corporate media was not delivering information. And it was a propagandizing arm of the establishment. But now, since that's been exposed to so many people and faith in corporate media has dramatically dropped, unfortunately, the step people have seemed to have taken is now they go to people like Jones. Like, if he was right about corporate media being false, he must be right about these other things. And I think that's really the problematic step is, if you're someone who cares about fact-based information and true journalism, what are you defending? Like, what do you defend, right? You have all these different angles. On the one hand, you're attacking corporate press. You're attacking some alternative press, but defending others in the independent press. And, you know, to Nick's point, it does seem like a very complex, almost like sporting event where you're getting hit from all sides and just trying to keep the yards you've already gained.
Well, we're in a post-truth world, and a post-truth world in which the references and the citations that we make are all up for grabs. So as a professor at East Bay, I am now finding myself in a space of negotiating with students what I think are authoritative sources, because that center where we used to be sure what authoritative sources were, we've lost that center. Again, this goes to my point about the fringe becoming the mainstream. So it's becoming increasingly more and more difficult to determine what is and what is not real news. Now, face it, Fox, you know, I'm not necessarily blaming Fox for starting this, but they were certainly big players in this. And professional liars like Sean Hannity play a big role in this, the willingness to embrace these ideas. In truth, Hannity's always embraced this because he also embraced, I've forgotten the name of the theorist who inspired the Oklahoma bombings, but I know that in the early portion of his career, he embraced that individual on his program. So he's always done this kind of stuff. And, you know, you can even look at what he did with respect to the Trayvon Martin case, right, and defending this boy's death. He's always been open to this. And Fox itself has been open to accepting these kinds of fringy voices into its mainstream as a way to kind of foment its extremist base.
I recently saw a performance, actually, in Berkeley by Mike Daisy, the solo performer and comic, but really serious satirist and commentator about public affairs. He did a show called The End of Journalism, and he really goes in that performance to this idea, precisely what you're saying, Nick, that how do you defeat an irrational and non-truth-based argument, the emotional pull? That is really powerful. But it's possible, like you're saying about the mainstream or about fact-based media, now people may appreciate those mainstream corporate media sources, or the less corporate the better. But I mean, the New York Times and Washington Post of the world are becoming increasingly more important because they adhere to old journalistic norms. If they get thrown out the window and somehow succumb to this era and either play the same game by abandoning fact and abandoning rigorous journalism, and go to fight in the street, sort of street level of media, you could call it, then we've really lost that middle. But I think they're holding their ground, in a sense, by calling out the lies and being explicit. So this is the battle, really, of this journalistic era we're in now.
They're being bullied, right, Nolan? I mean, you know, and people respond differently to bullying. You either cower or you decide, you know what, I'm going to hit back. So there are some media outlets that we're seeing, Washington Post, New York Times, CNN to some degree, who I never thought that I would be sort of laying out
on the side of.
Exactly, yeah. Maybe are responding to the fact that they just don't want to be bullied.
You're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Nicholas Bayham III, and as always, our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin. Nick, you bring up a real good point here, too, about not only not being able to tell the difference between fact and opinion in this post-truth America, but also the difference between commentator and journalist. I think there's plenty of people who you could probably can ask and would be answer that Hannity's a journalist, which he's not, right? He's this commentator. And I think a lot of these people have posited themselves as bastions of information. But they really, again, pull this stuff off the internet. And so they've made like this celebrity status for themselves, really just finding the most outrageous fodder that's so controversial it draws the attention of its readers and listeners.
Precisely. I mean, he's no more authoritative than anyone that I might pull over on the side of the road with and have a beer with. That's it. He's an entertainer at best. And frankly, this is why it's so easy to incorporate people into his news program who otherwise would be in their grandmother's basement in their tighty-whities drinking chocolate milk and posting strange screeds on liberal websites.
Yeah, well, the Hannity, I mean, Fox clearly, I think Fox should be blamed, will be blamed in the history books. They really are. That media source, what Roger Ailes did in the 90s during the Clinton years, turning fellatio into a national and international discussion that derailed the presidency and everything else that they did socially and culturally to sort of elevate the arguments of the right. Fox mastered that, and Ailes was a master of that, and Hannity, and really their entire cast represents that transformation of news. I don't know how you reverse from it. They are what America, certainly red state and really middle America, they are the news for them. They lost touch with ABC and CBS and NBC long ago. Not that they were, you know, all that great themselves, but Fox took over.
I would agree that Fox deserves part of the blame for this post-truth world, but they also followed what was already being done on radio with people like Rush Limbaugh, and I would say it was copied by MSNBC for the Democrats and the other side. And I think one of the big mistakes, especially in the Obama years, is progressives focused a lot on Fox News, but there were these, I think, bigger enemies of reality being created in like Breitbart and Jones that many of us, myself included, sort of thought were so kind of crazy and out there that they would never be a mainstream problem. They were just some, those of us who studied media knew about. And it's shocking in 2017 to be like, they actually became the main sources of discourse. I think Fox is trying to keep up with Breitbart and trying to keep up with Jones at this point.
But I guess a natural question, Nolan, why hasn't the left and the progressive community, why haven't we put forward those voices. I mean, you mentioned, yeah, whatever, Rachel Maddow, you can say MSNBC and Chris Hayes. Some of these guys are good and fine, but they certainly aren't powerful in the sense that their words echo across the country. They do within our echo chamber of liberals and progressives, but why do you think the left isn't capable of summoning voices that can be as powerful, but simply from the other side, as these guys like Alex Jones?
You know, they're brilliant people, but they are naive. And I think part of this is that the left hasn't really recognized that this is a part of a long-term political project that's been going on with the right. Rush Limbaugh knows exactly what he is doing. All the Samuel Huntington followers, all of the Ayn Rand followers, the Breitbart folks who are influenced by a potpourri of fascist regimes, they know what they're doing, and they've been working at this, I believe, for decades. I could make the argument to you, I guess I am, that in a post-civil rights era, this project was probably launched somewhere along the line of people who wanted to bring us back to that pre-civil rights era of the 1950s, where people of color, women, gays, lesbians, immigrants all understood their place. And their place was out of the mainstream, okay, and stepping off of the sidewalk into the street to accommodate the great white man who was walking down the street. It's not difficult to read that kind of resentment of everything that happened that was transformative from the civil rights movement forward in the voices of these people. Your Rush Limbaughs, et cetera, they all lived through that transformation in the 60s. And are deeply invested in their resentment and pushback against that progress.
Yeah, and I think that pushback against government getting involved and in attempting to support those groups in the 1960s led to a backlash, as Nick is talking about. And that backlash also served the interest of a lot of corporations, for-profit corporations, who didn't want government involved in anything. And so they're able to tap into that fear, that racism, sexism, and homophobia, and use it to create a for-profit media empire where there's really no corporations supporting the leftists who are fighting for social justice. It's not a really for-profitable model to fight for that. And I think that you do have some people like Maddow and Hayes and others who are dabbling in for-profit media, but they have to stay within the realm of what the establishment accepts. They can't be too critical of some economic structures. They can't be too critical of some media structures because they'll lose the foundation for being able to speak. So they sort of, I would say, probably justify it, and that we can have conversation about these issues, but ignore these issues. At least I'm doing this, even though I can't do that. But the larger structures thus remain in place, and we don't really move forward on that football field analogy that Nick was giving us earlier.
And what it really does is it circles you back to what you started, what we started the conversation with, which is, what is fascism, and are we there? Are we heading there in America? That's the marriage of business and corporate life with a anti-immigrant and a virulent xenophobic kind of hate-driven narrative. That is the core of fascism, and that seems to be what now we're speaking about.
Well, that is a good segue to get into our guest, Alexander Reed Ross, who we will talk to after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Nicholas Baham III, and as always, our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin. We're going to shift gears now and interview Alexander Reed Ross. Alexander has been an organizer for more than 10 years. He is a former editor at the Earth First Journal and put together the anthology Grabbing Back Against the Global Land Grab, published by AK Press in 2014. His current book, which we'll be discussing today, is Against the Fascist Creep. It takes the reader through the bizarre and esoteric history of fascism and its attempts to infiltrate both left and right. He currently teaches in the geography department at Portland State University. Alexander, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So we've had some discussion here in the studio about fascism thus far and the way it's being covered in the press. What can you tell us about your newest book, Against the Fascist Creep?
Trump became sort of leader of the Wingnut Tea Party branch of birthers. And from there, he gained a significant right-wing reactionary following, which he was able to parlay into his presidential bid. And through that campaign, he became kind of a figurehead for a lot of Nazis and traditionalists and old-school Southern neo-Confederates. And so it was through that coalition, if you will, of fascists that Trump was able to really compete for presidency and eventually win.
How would you explain fascism to someone? We've had some discussion about the term and its different usages. How would you explain the term to someone?
Well, I definitely agree with what's called the new consensus that was developed in the early 90s, that fascism actually does have an ideology. It's not just pure irrationalism. However, the ideology itself is fundamentally based on deception and lies. So it's basically a mythopoetic ideology. It creates its own myth, its own alternative universe of alt facts. And through this sort of dimension, it calls for a rebirth of the classical nation, right? So in this sense, I personally have said that Make America Great Again is very similar to this, what is technically known as palingenetic ultranationalism. However, since Trump never fully agreed with the idea publicly of creating a white ethnostate in the United States, he is really sort of on the outskirts, the margins of linkages and networks between the radical right and fascism itself.
Alexander, this is Michael Levitin jumping in here. How do you see the element of spectacle? I think that was really key in that, if nothing else, that anyone tuning in, and Americans notoriously are not very tuned in to global events, certainly, and a lot of the time domestic ones, everyone was able to see the spectacle. They saw it with Bernie Sanders as well. They saw lots of crowds and tons of enthusiasm, but it was a whole other level and a style that you could pick up just by watching anything televised by Trump during his campaign. And the idea of mockery and humor and showboating and kind of a guy who gets up there and will make the audience laugh by, you know, denigrating this person, that group. I mean, that also harkens back to traditional kind of Nazi. That's what Hitler and Goebbels and the early Nazi creators did, isn't it? Becoming a spectacle and a show for the public.
Absolutely. However, it's also what people like George Wallace did, and there was a fair amount of violence as well that followed George Wallace around. Joe Lowndes, who's a really great scholar currently teaching at the University of Oregon, has a book about the Southern strategy where he discusses how the violence outside of George Wallace's campaign events actually helped his campaign gain some momentum because, like you're saying, it became part of the spectacle. And this is also true of Jean-Marie Le Pen in France during the 80s and 90s, perhaps. So that sort of demagoguery, if you will, is a tried and true political tradition. And really with Trump, it was hyperbole, right? Everything is the best thing ever. You know, nothing is quite thought through and the nuance is completely lost. It's either everybody should feel completely comfortable with him and the reality that he's spinning on the one hand, or everybody should feel completely terrified and terrorized by anybody who speaks against Trump and unsettles the sort of status quo. So that sort of thing, that sort of spectacle, I think, was important, especially in the midst of a divided country, because it is a divided country. So Trump really plays to people's emotions, and he builds his audience, like you're saying, by scapegoating people and so on. So it is absolutely something that, say, your Hitler or Mussolini would have done. And this is a comparison that's made over and again. However, it's not restricted to them. It's generally sort of a populist political strategy or technique, rather.
Alexander, this is Dr. Baham. You mentioned George Wallace, but I wonder if you could elaborate some of the other past discursive formations that really lay the groundwork for Trump's white ethno-nationalist government. And then if you could also kind of talk about the role that Steve Bannon plays in making this all happen.
Yes, absolutely. I think that takes us from the national level to the international level, because when you look at Trump, we're really talking about Americanism. I've argued that Americanism, as thinkers of populism like Cass Mudd have shown, really kind of begins in the 1830s, 1840s with the Know-Nothings, who are a sort of bizarre populist kind of group that really shunned immigrants in particular and cultivated this understanding of what is American, who is the true American, who really believes in America, and how do we define Americanism as opposed to immigrants in particular. And that sort of right-wing populism resurfaced especially in the later years of the People's Party, the initial populist party, where the leader of that particular political organization started really going after people like Booker T. Washington and immigrants. And then later on, that torch was sort of carried by Huey Long, who himself was not particularly far right wing, but his sort of coterie was. His people like the preacher Father Coughlin, who spearheaded Huey Long's Share the Wealth campaign after Huey Long was killed, really hated the Jews, and in the 1930s supported the New Deal until they thought it wasn't going far enough, and then supported Hitler's Nazi Germany. And so it was at that time, when there was a question about whether or not to get involved in World War II, that Americanism resurfaced. It had been captured by the Klan, talking about 100% Americanism. It resurfaced in the late 30s, early 40s with the America First Committee, talking about real Americanism means not going to war against Germany and that sort of thing. A lot of corporations and a lot of very prominent, wealthy Americans were, in fact, pro-Nazi leading up to World War II, and then they sort of switched to anti-communism. And so instead of being against entering World War II and being rather pro-Nazi, Americanism was transferred into being strictly anti-communist. And that was really McCarthyism, which was purportedly Americanism with its sleeves rolled up. But if you look into McCarthy's actual actions, he was coordinating an event with the successor to the first American Nazi Party, the Jewish American Bund. He was also working to derail war crimes tribunals in Germany with the help of the Socialist Reich Party, which was a Nazi party in Germany. So McCarthy himself was rather interested in Nazism after World War II underneath the current. And it was McCarthy's chief prosecutor, actually, Roy Cohn, who became Trump's conciliary and lawyer, along with Roger Stone, who became an advisor to Trump and was one of Nixon's dirty tricksters. And that's really where the Southern strategy meets anti-communism and old-school Americanism, that Trump sort of comes of age politically.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Nolan Higdon with my co-host Nicholas Bayham III and our senior correspondent Michael Levitin. And we have the pleasure of talking to Alexander Reed Ross about his book, Against the Fascist Creep. Alexander, I want to talk a little about the reaction you're getting to this book, because often we were talking about this earlier in the program, too. I think people sort of think in America that fascism never had any foothold here or that is sort of dead internationally. And so by you writing this type of book, what kind of reaction are you getting to using this term?
Actually, I've gotten a lot of positive responses. Some people have told me it's the book of 2017 and stuff like that, although I think that they said that once they received the book and haven't quite read it yet. You know, I hope it's the book of 2017, but right now I'm in that anxious stage where people are still kind of working through it, and it's just been released. And basically, the responses have been entirely positive. Everybody feels like this is absolutely the subject that we need to be discussing. And I think that there's a felt sense that the way that we've been identifying and understanding fascism over the last 20, maybe 30 years as this sort of specific ideal type that can be cordoned off and effectively sequestered or quarantined, is not adequate, right? We need a better understanding of political movements as hybrids, and we need a better understanding of how fascism asserts itself and under what conditions fascism gains power, or rather hegemony.
And you spoke earlier, too, about this dichotomy of the influence or position of both the left and right in the history of fascism. And I think in your description, you covered a lot of the right-wing elements of fascism. How did you see this playing out on the left, and what's been your reaction about talking about that as well?
More recently, you've seen fascism play out on the left, in particular with regards to international politics. I remember there was a statement put out by Eric Dreitzer of Counterpunch Radio saying that the anti-imperialist movement had been completely taken over by fascists. And the issue there is it's a long story, basically. Fascism emerged from imperialism as a way of capturing a lot of left-wing sentiment related to it. Mussolini himself came out of the radical left and then switched sides because of the outbreak of World War I. At that time, there was a lot of nationalist sentiment, a lot of saber-rattling, and it really swept up a lot of leftists. So the left is very vulnerable to waves of nationalism, very vulnerable to a sort of a lack of nuance in itself. I suppose everybody is. So that's really where we see some left-wing crossovers with regards to Syria, with regards to Putin, and even sometimes with regards to Trump, where members of the left have said Trump might be better than Clinton, or Trump and Putin getting along, you know, gee, that's swell. These are not left-wing critiques, and yet you see leftists presenting them.
Alexander, this is Michael Levitin again. Sticking to that point of globalization, I even would like to call it, I mean, that is a fascinating turn of events that Trump and Le Pen and the European movements to the right now kind of embody, the turning away from globalization and the fact that the anti-globalization movement was a leftist movement, the one that came out of Seattle and the anti-WTO movement. That is our progressive base. That was being shouted about decades before Trump got a hold of it and turned it into his right-wing movement of get rid of the TPP and jobs for Americans and no more of this sending our jobs overseas, etc. I mean, that really is kind of a hijacking of what was the anti-globalization movement.
Well, that's a really fascinating issue, because if you actually look at the history of fascism, sometimes it's the other way around. I mean, not that the left is hijacking fascism, but that fascism isn't just a hijacking, but it's coming out of the same roots in a very distorted fashion. So, like, for example, a lot of people think, well, fascists had to have been opposed completely to decolonization, but that's simply not true. The fascists supported Nasser. They supported Perón. Nasser brought fascists into his regime to create anti-Semitic propaganda. Fascists were running guns to the National Liberation Front in Algeria, while other fascists were fighting them. So there have been inter-fascist squabbles over whether or not to support certain forms of national liberation on the grounds that they're nationalists and that Europe should have a national liberation front to liberate people from NATO and so on in order to send the immigrants packing and create a national socialist Europe of nations or a breakdown of ethno-states or something like that. So that's in the 70s. And then if you get into the 80s and 90s, it turns out that Le Pen and National Front were protesting against GATT, you know, the predecessor to the WTO. And what they did, along with like Alex Jones and people like that, is create this alt universe where globalization was a creation of the left. Globalization was the economic expression of an ideology that they referred to as globalism, which is created by cultural Marxists and Jews who are trying to deracinate the people of Europe and white people in the United States and create this sort of backwater, impure, corrupt world and society through which plutocrats can feel free to exploit everybody. So when you actually look at the way that fascists treated or talked about the WTO protests in 1999, they tended to be in favor of it. You can see Louis Beam, the inventor of the term leaderless resistance in its right-wing milieu, talking about how great the protests of Seattle were, or Matt Hale from the creativity movement. So going into the early 2000s, you find these fascists like Claudio Muti entering into organizations against globalization and anti-imperialism in Italy and trying to steer them towards fascism. And even in Poland and so on, this is an ongoing thing where there was an attempt by fascists like Bill White, for example, to co-opt or rather to lead, you know, to take leadership from the left in the anti-globalization movement. So really, anti-globalization has already been part of their National Socialist critique or platform. It's just found its greatest expression in Trump because of the rise of more paleoconservative ideology due to mass reaction against the sort of neoliberal policies that actually have put so many people out of work and cause so many problems for people throughout the world.
You're listening to the Project Censored radio show, and we are talking to Alexander Reed Ross about his book, Against the Fascist Creep. We will continue our conversation with him right after this short musical break. You're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Nicholas Baham III and our senior correspondent Michael Levitin. We are talking to Alexander Reed Ross about his book Against the Fascist Creep. Alexander, you were talking about neoliberalism and its rise, and there's been some debate about this, about neoliberalism versus fascism. Like, that's the state of where U.S. politics are at. Can you talk a little bit about how the relationship between fascism and neoliberalism in 2016, 2017, is, as you see it?
This is a very complicated question. Fascists clearly don't like neoliberalism and have put Trump up as this kind of savior or figurehead, but at the same time, they've maintained a kind of a critical support, almost in like this Leninist way, with Trump's regime. They really see themselves as a vanguard of the sort of decline of the liberal world and the rise of a new reactionary conservatism that they'll be able to turn into a socialist movement. However, when you look at the people that Trump has set up in his administration, they're all fundamentally turning neoliberalism into a deeper imperial structure in the United States. They are against public schools and things like that. And if you want, you can return to 19th century liberalism of the Industrial Revolution to see these kinds of policies and what they create. So it is a movement against the social advances and economic advances of the New Deal and Great Society and returning back to 19th century liberalism at its worst in the economic terms while, you know, discarding all of the aspirations of equality and freedom and democracy. So in those terms, it's the conservative revolution, I suppose. And that term has the weight of involvement with the Nazi Party in the 20s and early 30s. And I think actually would resonate with people like Bannon, who support these sort of elitist philosophers like Evola and Dugin. So again, it's a difficult question. It also has to do with Brexit and the breakup of the European Union at the moment. Although I think that with the Trump regime's sort of impasses over the past few months. People in Europe are looking at this breakdown and trying to think through a different way of addressing the decline of neoliberal policies and potentially better systems that would not lead to so dramatic of a social breakdown.
Alexander, I'm interested in your research to know the unique history of race in the United States compared to other places. How does that sort of stand up with the version of fascism here in the U.S. compared to other places?
Well, the U.S. has developed this idea of white nationalism through fascism, which is a little bit different from a lot of the fascist movements in Europe. You know, the fascist movements of Europe are very sort of interested in returning to pagan traditionalism and sort of going toward ethnicities, you know, competing ethnicities within modern nation states and sort of breaking down the ideas of modern nation states and the citizen participant in democratic liberal politics, moving instead toward homogeneous ethnostates, Burgundians or Normans or Saxons and Prussians and whomever. So creating sort of homogeneous ethnostates based on cultural practice and elitism, you know, traditional hierarchies and connections between blood and soil, returning all the way back to a very ancient sort of mindset. Whereas in the United States, there is this sort of territorial imperative of breaking away into an ethnostate, but that ethnostate would specifically be a white ethnostate, wherein the different sort of ethnicities are not quite as pronounced. And also the return to paganism in the United States fascist movement is challenged, I would say, by a very strong presence of Christian identity, which is this sort of old, bizarre, cultish variation of Christianity that most Christians wouldn't even identify as Christian. It's a very bizarre sort of faith.
This is Michael again. Just jumping on that point, America will be white minority. It will be a majority non-white country very shortly, and everyone's aware of that. That's clearly what this election was about, was the white and white nationalists, but also standard working class white communities that are feeling that encroachment of liberalism and multiculturalism and that their lifestyles, it's not like it was. But how does that version of fascism, this is not like the European societies where really a minority are darker, other looking kind of faces. This is a country that is built on our multiculturalism and in a white minority future. What future would that sort of ultra white nationalist fascism hold? It doesn't seem to have its base, in fact.
Yeah, I think that in terms of this being a country founded on multiculturalism, if you really want to go back to the founding fathers, it wasn't. It was a country founded on the elitism of private property owners and a democracy fundamentally predicated on colonial expansion and racism and sexism, of course. And so it wasn't until the 1960s that the rights to vote and to go to the same schools and things like that were really firmly enshrined. And then from there on, you have the massive resistance of the South and so on and so forth. So in our lives, perhaps we have been exposed to multiculturalism as a building block of the United States, as something that is enshrined in the Constitution and whatnot. However, in the long range, the Make America Great Again slogan could feasibly be about moving back to before the Civil War. So in that case, there are two things I would say is that, first of all, I think that you're right that the democratic foundations of our society have sent fascists into a complete panic. And that's why you see things like the Muslim ban. And that's why you see things like building a wall. That's why you see things like trying to get the National Guard to deport immigrants, Mexican immigrants mostly. And so these are drastic measures of the extreme right deliberately directed towards transforming the demographics of the United States. And fascism has always had a really intense obsession with demographics. So that's exactly the point of Trump's policies, I would say. And then the other thing is that fascism has never been about democracy. It's always been anti-democracy and anti-equality. So what they want not only is to overhaul the demographic content of the United States, but they also want to overhaul the specific governing institutions within the United States. And that includes, in the 1930s, they sort of laid out this platform of destroying the independent judiciary, destroying Congress in anything but name, and appointing a sort of executive council. And so that's one of the interesting things where you see Trump going after the independent judiciary, saying so-called judges and things like that, is that fascists absolutely hate the independent judiciary and want an authoritarian executive council. So that's a big red flag there. Again, like I said, I think that the question of whether or not Trump is sort of a fascist is a bit difficult because, you know, he's not going to come out and say, hey, I'm a fascist, and everything else is sort of circumstantial. However, the question of whether or not this is a fascist country now because he's in power is easier to answer, and we can definitely say no, it's not.
Alexander, we just have a minute or two left, and I don't want to leave our listeners depressed. So do you have any potential solutions that you could offer or that you would recommend for our listeners to look into?
Well, I think that the solutions are right in front of us and happening every day. I think people are really getting together. They're opposing the Muslim ban. They've stopped the Muslim ban, effectively. And that's part of a democratic process. You know, that's a huge step forward. People are opposing deportations now, and that's a hugely important thing. Sometimes, even though the judiciary is appointed and not elected, they submit to the power of the people. This is what happened with SB 1070, the famous Papers, Please law in Arizona, and that's where Kobach is coming from. So the more people resist, the more of an effect that they have on what ends up happening. And SB 1070 was totally gutted by the judiciary. This is not to say, like, everybody fall back on the judiciary, but to continue to struggle, because the more that we struggle, the more the authoritarianism breaks down, and the more the cracks appear, the more unstable the regime is. So I'm not one of these people who says that if we take down Trump, then we end up with Pence, who's going to be worse. I want to take down Trump. I want to take down Pence. You know, I agree with the Argentinian slogan, que se vayan todos, kick them all out. This is a repulsive regime. It's anti-democratic, and the people need to stand up for what we want instead of what we're given.
He is Alexander Reed Ross, and his book is Against the Fascist Creep. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. It's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
You've been listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Nolan Higdon with Nicholas Bayam III. Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips are our executive producers and hosts. Michael Levitin, our senior correspondent. Our interns are Alicia Eduardo and Desiree McSwain. Anthony Fess is our producer. Erica Bridgman, our engineer. The Project Censored show airs on nearly 40 stations around the U.S. Please follow us and like us on Facebook and visit our website online at projectcensored.org, where you can find the archives of all our radio shows for the past 6 years, as well as 40 years of news that didn't make the news. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time.
The people together can overthrow the system. We got the love, uplift our brothers and